Welcome to episode 12 of the Serious About Security podcast for Monday, July 23rd, 2012, brought to you by the Greater Lafayette Security Professionals Group, Secure Purdue, and the Center for Education and Research in Information Assurance and Security, or SIRIUS, at Purdue University. Let me introduce the host of today's podcast. I'm Preston Wiley, CISSP, CCNA.
This is Keith Watson, Research Engineer at SIRIUS.
And I'm Mike Hill, CISSP. In announcements today, the next Greater Lafayette Security Professionals meeting will be on August 9th at 11:30 a.m. Pascal Munier will present information on trusted digital repositories. Please remember to bring your lunch. The Metasploit workshop that was canceled for July has been rescheduled for September 13th.
The schedule for the fall SIRIUS Security Seminar is starting to fill up, and the first session will be held on August 22nd with Scott Anderson from Lockheed Martin. The seminar will begin at 4:30 p.m. in Stuart G52 if you're here on the Purdue campus, and will also be shown on the Purdue channel on the local cable system and on the campus cable system. And these seminars are recorded and made available as podcasts on YouTube as well. So information is available at the SIRIUS website, www.ceris.purdue.edu.
In news this podcast, we have two items. Google Chrome was the stable branch was updated to 20.0.1132.57 on July 11th, which corrected three high security vulnerabilities and updated Flash Player. And Mozilla Firefox and Thunderbird were both updated to the release 14, which corrected, ironically, 14 vulnerabilities. Four of those were critical, four of those were high, and that happened on July 17th. Firefox oddly updated to 14.0.1, while Thunderbird updated to version 14. And we, in this release, we suggest that users enable the click-to-play feature in Firefox to avoid automated plugin exploits. I believe that is just a feature where when a plugin gets installed, you have to click on the plugin in order for it to function. And that is the news for this podcast.
So the first article we wanted to talk about today was related to some information regarding how social networks are being used by sexual predators and how various companies are responding to this issue. And basically, the title from the Reuters article indicates that they're having uneven results. And I think that's true if you read through this article. Basically, there are a couple of companies highlighted here. One is obviously Facebook, which has, at last check, 901 million active monthly users. And I think that's kind of leveling off now that they've IPO'd, but that will remain to be seen what happens there in terms of their growth. But regardless, they have a large number of people that are members of Facebook, and yet they have a very small staff. Also, I believe the last count I saw for Facebook staff were about 2,500 people. So 2,500 people watching a network of 901 million. So you can see right there, there's a little bit of a challenge. And if you ever read through some of the comments posted by people on Facebook, they complain quite a bit about Facebook. So we'll have to see what that happens. But getting back to this article, some of the concerns here were sexual predators on the site chatting with underaged persons, and basically, Facebook talked briefly, the chief security officer, Joe Sullivan from Facebook, talked briefly about some of the techniques they use to monitor for these things. One of the issues that he highlighted was that they never wanted to build a service in which they were monitoring the conversations of people directly. And while they don't talk specifically about what techniques are used, apparently they have some software that does monitor conversations and looks for situations in which a sexual predator might be trying to prey on an underaged person. So they look at the social graph, which is kind of your list of friends and another person's list of friends, and try to map the connections together. And if they come across a connection that doesn't seem to make sense, that might be one indicator that there could be an issue going on. And then the assumption is, at least on my part, that they use a series of keywords or phrases that might indicate somebody attempting to prey upon a younger individual. And when they do find those situations, they contact the appropriate authorities. So part of the problem here is whether you like Facebook or not, the question is, how does this monitoring work and what level of monitoring is it? So if you have a variety of friends on Facebook and most of them are your age or older, but they're not teenagers, then you're probably not going to run into an issue. If you are friends with some of your children's friends, that might be a problem. Not that you're doing anything wrong, but that you might get flagged in some way. Now, I don't know if this is actually true, but this is a concern I have, certainly. So that's something to consider. How often does this happen? Well, they don't really talk about that. We would have probably heard about more issues of people being arrested for this sort of thing if it were actually happening a lot. So I suspect we're not seeing it yet. But it also could be that this technology that they're using or the processes around it are not quite fully developed yet, and they're still testing the waters, if you will. Some of the other issues highlighted in the article talked about a mobile application called Scout, which after some issues that came up with some conversations that occurred over that service, the Scout service basically banned users between 13 and 18, roughly, or any minor that had an account on there. They were banned from actually using the service. If you look at what Scout is, it's kind of like a Foursquare type location service. You're checking in and seeing who's nearby. Strangers, in fact, that are nearby. And in fact, the New York Times Bits column or blog mentions that it's a flirting app. Now, if you have minors playing with a flirting app, I think that says it all right there. And the other sad thing is that this company actually got $22 million in financing. I think that's a little – they had a little problem with their business model here perhaps, but that's just me. Anyways, so I think it's interesting that we have these social networks that are attempting, whether successful or not remains to be seen, but attempting to watch for, monitor for, and catch sexual predators on their networks. Obviously, this is a big problem, especially when you sign up for an account and it asks you your age and you can lie about it and it really doesn't matter because there's no way to verify that. And so we have the Child Online Protection or Child Online Privacy Protection Act, which is basically effectively bans people under the age of 13 from using most of the internet services in which you have to sign up for an account. However, it's estimated that roughly 10 to 20% of the users on Facebook are actually under the age of 13. So obviously they have a little issue there within verifying the age of many of their users. So the occurrence and the likelihood of sexual predators being actively seeking this type of user may be actually pretty high. But we don't really have any stats on that, sadly, so it's really difficult to tell. But I thought it was interesting that Facebook is talking a little bit about it, but they don't want to share all this because obviously they're trying to keep the people who are doing these things in the dark about their techniques. So this is why I picked this one. And thought I would see what you guys think of it.
Well, I have to say I applaud Facebook's efforts for taking the step to monitor this type of activity. I might be alone in that. I know some others may have the feeling that, you know, what I do on Facebook, you know, privacy settings, they can see my conversations. You know, I guess I'm not naive. When I signed up for Facebook, I realized that somewhere someone was sitting that could monitor anything I said if they so desired. Now, it probably wouldn't be in their best intent. My Facebook postings are probably pretty boring for them. But, you know, in reality, they have this system set up. And I think it's in their best interest that they pursue these types of things. Reading the article, you were saying, you know, keeping stuff in the dark. I think they absolutely need to keep stuff in the dark. And actually, I think they may have even shared a little too much in this article. I would have preferred that, you know, the article was, you know, Facebook helped catch this guy, and it was really more vague. And basically, Facebook said, yes, we have some stuff in place. We have some processes. We're not going to tell you how they work, but they help us catch people like this. Because I think the more things that people know about how it works, then they can learn how to operate outside those lines. For example, in the article, it talked about the fact, for one thing, that they use technology that has a very low false positive rate, which basically means that when they get a positive hit, the likelihood is probably very high. It matches several patterns and says this is really likely to be an event where there's a sexual predator involved. When that's good from the sense of, you know, they're only going to try to go after people where that's a very high rate. But later on in the article, I read that for every one that gets flagged, another 10 or so probably don't. So just knowing that statistic, you know, some people can kind of look at it and say, well, if I operate outside these lines a little bit, maybe it won't pick me up. Another thing it mentioned was they only do this on newly formed or loose relationships at this point in time. So if it's a pre-existing established relationship over a number of months, years, they didn't exactly define what makes it an established relationship. But the likelihood of that getting flagged is lower. So, I'll be honest, they didn't share a terrible amount. But from my opinion, I would have liked to have seen them share less and basically kind of put that fear out there a little bit more. Yes, we are watching for certain events, and we're looking for certain. And when these patterns are matched, our team looks at it and they call in the authorities when necessary. But I really do applaud the fact that they did this. And, you know, it's my hope that, you know, as time goes on, they will continue to be aggressive about it and try to shut these things down because, you know, social networking technology just makes this, it could be a playground for these types of individuals. And I think Facebook has a responsibility to be doing this and maybe even to make it more clear on how you're communication on Facebook is being tracked, just so folks don't feel like they can go out there and do these things as easily. So, like I said, I'm really glad to see that they're doing this. I think the real difficult part is, and you already touched on this, Keith, is adults and children can both lie about their age. So, I mean, it can go in both directions. A child can sign up on Facebook and say they're 40 years old, and an adult can sign up on Facebook and say they're 13. So, you know, ultimately I'd like to see those things get better, but that sort of goes against the internet a little bit there because we need to remain a little bit anonymous. So Facebook can't really require you to use like a credit card to sign up. They want to make it easy to get on. But on the other hand, then your identity is really not verified. So I see that being an issue that we'll continue to struggle with.
Well, obviously, from a privacy perspective, this leads to other questions on what else can they, if they're looking for this, what else can they look for on here? And how can this, you know, police may say, well, okay, they're assisting us with this. Well, what else can they assist us with? You know, and, you know, it's a slippery slope argument, and, you know, it's not necessarily going to happen, but I mean, privacy, people concerned about their privacy may question what else are they going to look for, and I'm not really sure if this, this type of, use of the data is necessarily outlined specifically in their privacy policy and stuff like that either, that they're actually monitoring this sort of thing and could actually intercept your chat sessions and get this type of data. I mean, their privacy policy specifically mentions protecting minors and you know, you could kind of fit it within their privacy policy under protecting minors, but I'm not sure if this sort of use of your data is actually highlighted specifically in their privacy policy.
So, as we record this today on Monday, this falls into a greater issue of adults preying on children, and the fact that Penn State University was fined by the NCAA today, with Coach Paterno being more involved than we suspected originally. And so I think this article highlights an issue that is coming to light with the recent news events. And so that kind of drives some of this concern and discussion, which is good. We need to have that. Whereas the Penn State stuff occurred offline, the Scout application, there were, and I didn't mention this, there were allegedly three related rapes of children involved in that, which occurred allegedly over the service. Whether that's true or not, I'm sure that will be battled out in court somewhere. The issue here is that this just happens to be the news topic that discussion is happening around in wake of let's say, Penn State's issues and with their coaching staff. And so I'm not trying to diminish the minors and children involved in these events by any stretch, but I think there's a heightened awareness of it right now. And so this discussion is a good thing to have. The other thing that I wanted to mention quickly is there are a couple companies that are involved with actually providing this monitoring service for a variety of online bulletin boards and forums. The issue is that they are dealing with a large number of conversations happening at once. They have a small staff. And according to this, there's many months of nothing happening followed by a few minutes of your hair on fire. And that seems to be probably something you expect to see in this type of monitoring. We don't have, you know, statistically, there aren't a lot of child predators compared to the population. But when they do happen and when these events happen, it's a big crisis that needs to be dealt with. The problem is that how do you pay for a monitoring service to monitor these websites without spending a huge amount of cash to do it? And from the report, it doesn't seem like it's a business that you're likely to be in for several reasons. One is you've got this staff to conversation ratio and the costs of associated with having that level of staffing to do that. And the other is that some of these sites are ad-driven. And when you're filtering and when you're monitoring and moderating these conversations, that depresses your ad rates. So if you're losing money through reduced ads, you can't make up the cost to pay for this monitoring service at the same time. Something has to give here. And so typically, depending on the site's mission, if it's a site designed to comply with COPPA, for example, those sites may have to go to a membership type service because they can't make up the revenue in the ad-supported model. And if they do that, well, that's going to effectively ruin it because nobody's going to sign up for it. That sadly is the world we live in, where if it costs money, people are less interested in it sometimes. So that's a concern as well. So I think there's a lot of these monitoring services that may do a good job, but they're too costly. At least they are right now. And Facebook's model is we're going to do it in-house. We're going to take the algorithmic approach to it, and maybe they'll have good success with that. Hopefully that could be mimicked in other services as well and do it for less money, right, than what it costs today.
Yeah, and you know, an opportunity Facebook has, I don't know if it would be in their best interest as far as a business, but you know, showing that they're working with law enforcement, they could even set up, you know, some sting operations. You know, you've probably seen it on television shows where, you know, they set up these stings. You know, they could actually have law enforcement officials on Facebook kind of trying to sneer some of the sexual predators that are out there. Like I said, they'd have to evaluate that from a business perspective to see if that would be in their best interest. But Facebook, you know, for law enforcement is a great tool. There's so many, like you said, 900 million users on Facebook. You know, it would be an opportunity if law enforcement could take advantage of it. But they need to work with Facebook. And, you know, as far as I know, maybe something like that already happens discreetly and they don't really talk about it. But, you know, I just think that if Facebook users were aware of the monitoring and how it was being done, and as you mentioned, Preston, they don't maybe don't necessarily spell it out, but they say they're in it to protect minors. So if people understand that, hopefully that will deter that type of behavior. I'm sure that's what Facebook would like to happen, is for these types of things not to occur, because if they occur within Facebook, that hurts their reputation. So it is in their best interest to try to minimize or eliminate these things from happening. So they may have an opportunity there, like you mentioned, Keith, they have a small staff. Maybe they can bring on some law enforcement officials throughout the country and set them up in areas, and they can kind of be out there and maybe help bring it, help catch some of these people that are suspicious and doing some things on there. We'll have to see what they do, but I am pleased to see that they're at least doing something, while it's looking at data and we don't necessarily know what rules they're using. I'm pleased to see that they are at least taking steps along these lines and saying, we're not going to tolerate these things. We're going to report them and we're going to get this stuff stopped when we're aware of it. Okay, we'll move on to the next article now. This one is mine, and this one is which browser is safest? And this was posted online by Naked Security, and I thought this would be a lighter topic after tackling the last one to kind of to talk about. This was an article that kind of talked about the fact that Internet Explorer and Google Chrome and Mozilla Firefox are all starting to promote more security within their browser to distinguish themselves from each other, and talking about which browser may be your safest. And I thought this would be just a fun one to talk about amongst ourselves, because I happen to know that we all use different browsers kind of as our primary one. So I thought it could be an interesting conversation as far as, as folks that are heavily involved in security, what do we use and how do we recommend them to be used? So my browser of choice has been Firefox for the last several years. I was originally kind of a Netscape user back in the day, and I liked that Mozilla continued with Firefox. And I kind of got using Firefox. I think there was a time when it was really just Firefox and Internet Explorer, and Firefox had some security advantages at that point. So I started using it then, but I've just kind of continued on that. I guess they kind of got brand loyalty from me, because I've liked the upgrades they've made, and I've liked how things have progressed, and I like some of the features they have. I use them across Windows and Mac, so just really comfortable with the way it works. I like the plugins. One of my favorites is NoScript, and I keep that enabled on both platforms. So anytime new JavaScript, anytime I visit a new site and it has JavaScript, I have to specifically enable it for all of the sites that are brought in from that site that have JavaScript included. So I found that helps keep me safer. And, if I were to recommend a browser, I would recommend Firefox, just because of the ease of use I've had using it over the number of years. The fact that, I can easily use it on Windows or the Mac. I've never had any trouble with that. In fact, I use the feature where you sync up your bookmarks between the two systems, and it's been a great feature. So whether I'm using my laptop or my workstation or, a home computer, I can sync up all of those bookmarks instantaneously, and I can have all of them available to me. But, one of the things I think of as far as keeping it secure is I always run the latest version of the browser as well. So that's what I've used. And I thought it'd be good to have you guys talk about the browsers you use and see how different the browsers are that we're all using here.
I use one that wasn't talked about in the article, which is Opera, which I think has maybe 2% market share or something like that, according to a lot of the surveys that I've seen posted. But I've been using it for quite a while. I used it. The main reason I started using it is because it was the first browser to have tabbed browsing, and I really like tabbed browsing, and now they all do. But I continue to use it. I came close to switching to when because it didn't support extensions, and now it does. So, but I mean, it has most of the security features you'd expect to find in a browser. I use something called NotScript, which is basically no script for Opera. I use also a HTTPS redirect extension, which will redirect my, you know, Google things to HTTPS and other major sites to HTTPS, like Wikipedia and Yahoo and other things that are common. And I've been using it for a while, and I'm happy with it. They update it frequently. I'm running the latest version, and from a security perspective, it's not a highly, what I would call a highly targeted browser either. So that, you know, I don't really consider that as a reason to use it, but, you know, it probably keeps it, it's a little, maybe a little bit safer also because it's not a very common browser.
Okay, well, unlike you guys, I'm not happy with my browsers. I use a variety. I have installed Chrome and Firefox and Opera. I have, since I'm on a Mac most of the time, I have Safari available to me. And on the Linux platforms I use, I have Chrome and I have Firefox there. I flip back and forth. If I were to point to a secure browser, I kind of point towards Chrome merely because it has a lot of sandboxing capabilities built in. So if, for example, your tabs are running as a separate process, and if that happens to have a problem, it doesn't necessarily crash the whole browser. You just terminate that process and you can reload it, which sadly in version 20 and 21, I've had a lot of tabs just die for unknown reasons, and I've had to kill those pages. Not very happy about that. These are things like, keep in mind, this is Google Chrome and Gmail and Google Calendar are the tabs that are dying. Go figure. Firefox has less of a stellar history with security, in my opinion, and they've not addressed a lot of the security issues in the ways that have been somewhat proven by other developers such as Microsoft in Internet Explorer and Google Chrome in terms of sandboxing. Now, if you look at the latest and greatest info from Windows talking about IE 10, which will ship with Windows 8, I believe, they're talking more about sandboxing in their enhanced protection or enhanced protected mode. And they have this thing called the HTML5 sandbox. They have some other things called declarative security features. They've got memory protection. They've got this protected mode, which is kind of defense in depth. And they've got a lot of capabilities that they're built into that browser. Of course, it's not available yet. We have Chrome, which has done a lot in that area as well with sandboxing. And Firefox hasn't. And it was, if you did a look through some of the security issues that they've been having, it seems to be a lot of stuff that could have possibly been prevented through the use of sandboxing. They don't have it. So your fallback is to add an extension, which is NoScript. And I love NoScript. I've used it since it was a little baby, if you will, in the extension world. And that's fine and good, but you can't get you cannot easily get users that are not security gurus to use this silly thing. I have it installed on my wife's system, and it's set to allow all of the scripts to run. Now, my assumption, which may be incorrect, is that by allowing scripts from any site on any page she opens to run, not necessarily good, but there are some things that are protected in the background that you don't see, clickjacking sorts of things and things that try to exploit weaknesses in browsers. Those are on by default, but the actual JavaScript sometimes doesn't run. So it's very hard to get her to use it with the reminder that, oh, you have to go down and turn the scripts on. She doesn't know what a script is. And when you come to a site that has 12 different sites that load JavaScript, it's not a good solution for the average user. I can use it because I'm a security guy and I know roughly how these websites work. I can't ask my wife to do that. So from that point of view, I don't feel that that's a great option for her. Having it run in the background with not requiring her to make that selection is okay, but not great. There's nothing I've tried NoteScript, which is there's a one for Chrome, and I found it's unusable. And it hasn't been updated since December 2010 or 2011. It's been a while. Partly because the Google Chrome API for that sort of thing is not as nice as the Firefox one. So that's part of the problem there. It doesn't have anywhere close to the capabilities that NoScript has on Firefox. So I'm not happy with my browser options here. I've actually gone into the Chrome config and turned off some of their features. I've tweaked it the best I can, but I'm not happy. So I'm a reluctant Google Chrome user, given that the other options are not all that much better. Although I do fall back to Firefox occasionally.
Okay, well, let me flip this now just a little bit. Are there any browsers that you would discourage users from running? And I'm going to take out the easy, obvious choice outside of outdated packages. So we can't say discourage them from running IE6, for example. Obviously, we would mean the latest version of the browsers. Out of the existing browsers, are there any that you would say just avoid? Assuming, of course, that it's the latest version of the browser. Is there anything out there that a user should just stay away from, that it's going to be more prone to issues? Out of the box, you know, no plugins, no additional things. But if I got a brand new computer that could run any browser, it's this awesome computer, it can run Mac or Linux or Windows. Is there a browser I can download? Is there a browser out of all the choices? Is there one I could download that I just absolutely should not at this point in time? I should just stay away from.
That's hard to say, partly because we have no way to measure security for a browser. We don't. You can't take Google Chrome and Safari, for example, and set them side by side and run a comprehensive set of security tests against both of them and get a realistic idea of which one is more secure than the other. And we talked about these issues previously with some other, you know, taking two packages of software and say, well, that one's an A and that one's a B. Well, how do you measure that? Okay. We don't have that. So it's really hard to say, oh yeah, don't use Safari or don't use this or that or the other. That said, I would look to the company's reputation for addressing security issues in a timely manner. Because while we can't necessarily easily, we could do it if we put some engineering effort into it, I think. But since we don't have that measurement, I think it would be, as a secondary step, to look at the track record, if you will, of a company and their ability to, one, prevent these issues from getting in there, and two, addressing them when they are there. So given that measure, I would say I would avoid Safari from Apple, but I don't have a warm, fuzzy feeling in saying that's absolutely my answer.
Yeah, I was going to mention the same thing with Apple, because their stance on security issues is basically to say nothing until they're fixed, and sometimes that can be quite a while. But I think in a lot of cases with browsers, it's a lot of user education. I mean, you know, you can get infected or with any browser if you run a program. You know, if you downloaded something, do you want to run it? If you say yeah, you're going to get something. I mean, sooner or later, it's just going to happen. So, you know, user education is a huge factor in a user's use of a web browser. And, you know, I run NoteScript, and for two reasons. One, for privacy. It pretty much disables a lot of tracking because it can't run the JavaScript to do it. And it also protects me from malicious scripts. But again, if I click a run on a program, NoteScript isn't going to protect me from that.
Yeah, well, and honestly, it was kind of just a bit of a trick question, because you know, my thought on it is, You know, I totally agree. It's really about user education, running an updated version of your browser, installing plugins to help make you secure. I believe you can take the most secure browser, and as you already illustrated, Keith, that's not easy to measure or to say, but if we could, I could, in theory, I could take the most secure browser and I can still do very insecure things on it, and vice versa is true as well. I can run, in theory, the most insecure browser, but if I have the appropriate plugins and permissions set up, then I can run that with that browser in a secure manner. So I think the take-home message is just to kind of be aware of how your browser is behaving, keep it updated with the really latest security releases, and kind of be aware of kind of what's going on. But as you already mentioned, Keith, NoScript is I think NoScript is wonderful for those who have an interest in security and understand it. It's also, it can be really painful. I've been on some sites where I want an image to show, and it's like, I don't want to allow from this other site that's totally unconnected from the site I'm looking at. And there's like six of them available. And I'm like, which one of these do I need to allow so I can see this image? And they have this nice little option that says temporarily allow all. And sometimes I just click that because I just want to see the page the way it was meant to be seen. And then I want to know if I ever go back to those servers, it's not going to immediately just load all that content. So I totally understand what you're saying there. It is a great tool, but it has a bit of a learning curve to it as well. So, all right. Well, I'll leave it at that and move on to Preston's here.
Well, my article is related to the Apple App Store, and a Russian hacker basically found a way to defraud it. Defraud in-app purchases when you actually download an app from the App Store, and the app has the ability to purchase items or upgrade to a more enhanced version of the app or whatever. This hacker discovered a way by, from what I can tell, reverse engineering the protocol that he used to essentially defraud it. And the method of doing it is somewhat complicated. You basically have to create a fake certificate of authority, create a fake certificate based on that authority, and then change your DNS in order to point to this alternate app store. The app is essentially able to, the fake app store is able to pass off that the legitimate app store authorized this in-app purchase, and so is able to essentially purchase stuff from the app store without going through the real app store. At the moment, there are ways for developers to protect against this, which is actually validating the purchase of the app purchase. But the Russian hacker says it's only a matter of time before he's going to be able to fix that as well and essentially be able to bypass that part as well. This apparently works on iOS, and it also works with the he just recently said that he's got it to work with the App Store for Mac itself. So I think this is a fairly simple hack based on the app trusting stuff, when maybe it shouldn't trust things and there should be more layers of trust or lack of trust built into the apps and the API itself, and this is essentially trusting stuff that it doesn't necessarily shouldn't trust. So I just wanted to know what you guys thought of this this hack.
Well, it's an interesting attack. I know I spent a little time kind of looking through the article provided a diagram, and I got a little lost in it a bit because I think that was his future version of the hack where he wants to be able to get it to go. I don't know. To be honest, I just can't escape this feeling of, you know, how devious the users are to bypass this. Because ultimately, what the effect of this is just you know, stealing from the developer of the app is ultimately what you're doing, because you're rerouting stuff so that you can make an in-app purchase. So this is not to, you know, download a new app. This is one that you've purchased, yet, you know, you want to unlock new levels, or you want to achieve some status within whatever it is, a game, or unlock new features within the app that you purchased. So you can go through this, and essentially all that you're doing is taking money out of the developer's pocket, because that money is intended to go directly to the developer in support of that app. So, you know, it just seems, I don't know, just kind of the way things work, I guess. You know, someone going out of their way, I mean, these aren't complicated steps, but you can't just accidentally do this. You have to maliciously go out there and follow these steps in order to get this app upgrade, if you will, or unlock certain things in your app. So I really think Apple provided some workarounds for the developers to get around this, and they have mentioned that this will be fixed in 6, but I believe that's until October. So, you know, the developers, what they can do for now is kind of do the verification using their own server instead of the App Store server. But as you already mentioned, Preston, the person that made this exploit available is already working on a mechanism in which they can also kind of override it by having by talking to the developer server as well and making it misleading. So, you know, I think it's sad. This is really an event where it's kind of like, you know, this should not so much be an issue if we had just an honest user base out there, but obviously we don't. I'm sure there's several people that are taking advantage of this exploit. So, you know, my recommendation is, if I'm an iOS developer, I'm going to be looking closely at the workarounds and trying to secure this up as much as I can, because as we've alluded to on other podcasts, Apple doesn't always have the quickest turnaround time on addressing these things. So I think developers in this case really probably need to get out there and look to see if their app is vulnerable to this and put a fix in place so that they're not going to be losing money. And obviously this only affects apps where you can do in-app purchases. So I'm not sure what share of apps that affects, but this is only for making purchases within the app itself.
Yeah, it seems that, like you said, it's a vulnerability or weakness that's being exploited here. It does affect the developers. However, they can take some steps to prevent this from being a big issue. And those are outlined in the developer release notes that Apple has published. However, it is sad that Apple has not chosen to fix this particular weakness, as you know, by waiting until iOS 6 to ship and then not fixing it in Mountain Lion, because it's probably going to come out in a security update later. So I think the reason, and this is speculation, the reason that Apple's choosing not to directly address this issue now is because they're not losing any money. Let me correct that. They are losing some amount, because if I remember right, they still take 30% of in-app purchases as well. So they are, in a sense, losing some amount of money. But if they're not willing to jump in and correct it now, that tells me that there's not a big number of in-app purchases going on that would affect their revenue. That's a guess.
All right, well, with that, we'll wrap it up. I wanted to thank the hosts, Keith Watson and Mike Hill, as well as Sirius and Secure Purdue. I'm Preston Wiley. Have a safe and secure day.